From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, political changes in Lebanon and Syria and how they're affecting the Middle East and the U.S. First, we talk with Flint Leverett, the author of the new book, Inheriting Syria. He worked as an expert on Syria in the CIA during the Clinton administration and in the State Department and the National Security Council in the Bush administration. He resigned over disagreements with the Bush administration on policies towards Syria and the Middle East. Then we'll speak with Elizabeth Dibble, Deputy Assistant Secretary in the State Department's Bureau of Near Eastern Affairs. And we'll call Rami Khoury in Beirut, where he's editor-at-large of the Daily Star newspaper and writes a syndicated column. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The assassination last month of Rafik Hariri, the prime minister of Lebanon, brought thousands of people into the streets to protest Syria's military presence in their country. It pushed the pro-Syrian prime minister Omar Karami to resign last month, but then he returned to lead the formation of a new government. He's been unable to make real progress and has announced his plans to resign again. We're going to look at what the changes in Lebanon and Syria mean for the Middle East and for the U.S. My first guest is Flint Leverett, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution's Saban Center for Middle East Policy. He worked as an expert on Syria in the CIA in the late 90s. Then during the first 2 years of the Bush administration, he worked in the State Department and the National Security Council. He resigned because he disagreed with Bush administration policies on Syria and the Middle East. His book, Inheriting Syria, Bashar's Trial by Fire, comes out in mid-April. It's about Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, who succeeded his father Hafez al-Assad after his death in 2000. I'm interested in hearing if you think that there's a connection between the demonstrations that we saw in Lebanon, demonstrations to get Syria out of Lebanon. Mm-hmm. If you think that that's connected to the elections in Iraq. You know, one of the goals in the invasion of Iraq was to bring democracy to that country and to hope that democracy spread through the Middle East. Is what's happening in Lebanon a sign of its spreading, or is it unrelated?
It's a nice coincidence, and it's obviously something that the administration and its supporters want to claim as a byproduct of the administration's Iraq policy. Frankly, I don't believe that there's really any connection between what the United States has done in Iraq and the holding of elections in Iraq at the end of January and what we've seen in Lebanon. The demonstrations in Lebanon really were sparked by an unrelated event, that is the assassination of former Prime Minister Hariri on February the 14th. You saw that as serve as a kind of catalytic event for the opposition, galvanizing people to go into the streets to protest the longstanding Syrian presence, Syrian role in Lebanon. At the same time, you also saw that provoke even larger counter-demonstrations organized by Hezbollah. I think this is really a Lebanese drama that we're seeing played out before us, driven by longstanding forces and concerns within the Lebanese polity. It's not related in any significant way to Iraq.
In the United States, Hezbollah is on the list of terrorist groups, and Hezbollah's two main enemies are Israel and the United States. In Lebanon, it's a political party. And so, you know, we saw that the Hezbollah demonstrations in Lebanon were even larger than the demonstrations to get Syria out of Lebanon. So in this period of transition, how do you think that Hezbollah's role in Lebanon might change?
I actually think this is one area where U.S. policy at the moment runs serious risks of unintended consequences. Hezbollah is, I would argue, and I think most of my former colleagues in the U.S. intelligence community would argue, is the world's most capable terrorist organization. It is the group that before September 11 had killed more Americans than any other terrorist group in the world. It still today maintains an international terrorist network that is more capable of hurting American interests around the world than Al-Qaeda is. But we are embarked on a course which I think will inevitably lead to Hezbollah's empowerment as a political force in Lebanon. We saw in the demonstrations that you referred to just how much of a popular base it can command. If we really do push the Syrians out of Lebanon and try to create some new political order in Lebanon, if that order is going to be genuinely reflective of Lebanon's political forces, it is going to have to include Hezbollah in a significant way. And let's have no illusions, Hezbollah is going to come into a greater degree of political power still armed. It is not going to give up his arms, and with the Syrians gone, there will be no one there to disarm.
Has Syria been empowering Hezbollah or controlling Hezbollah?
It's been doing both. It has allowed Hezbollah to develop its military capabilities, particularly in the south. It has allowed Hezbollah to capitalize on its popular following and establish more of a political role for itself in Lebanon. At the same time, Syria has set limits on Hezbollah's operations. Syria, for example, has forbidden Hezbollah to target American interests in the region. It doesn't have a lot of influence on what Hezbollah does internationally, but within the region, it said you don't target U.S. interests. It has set limits in terms of the scope of Hezbollah's operations in the Sheba Farms area against Israeli forces. So I think Syria has played a dual role. On the one hand, empowering Hezbollah and using Hezbollah as a lever for it to pursue its own interests, but at the same time, setting some limits on what Hezbollah could do.
Hezbollah wants a fundamentalist state in Lebanon, right?
They say that they want to see the establishment of an Islamic state. That's right.
So is it possible that Lebanon will become one of those paradoxical places where we see it as heading toward democracy, but the majority ends up voting for an Islamic state, which the West would see as not exactly embodying democracy and certainly not embodying the spirit of Western democracy?
I think that that's very much the pattern that we're seeing played out in Iraq, where the dominant political force in Iraq at this point is Islamist Shia. They are balanced to some degree by Kurds, who are much more secular in their orientation. But if you just look at the numbers, the dominant political force in post-Saddam Iraq are Islamist Shia, who, while they are participating in democratic processes, I think have views regarding the proper political order for Iraq, regarding various social issues, regarding the role of religion in society, which are not exactly compatible with Western democratic norms. I think you do run this risk in Lebanon as well. I think that the course we are embarked upon right now, by pushing for a precipitous Syrian withdrawal from Lebanon, one of the consequences of this is going to be Hezbollah's empowerment. Hezbollah is going to become more powerful, more influential, have more of a role in Lebanese political life, and both from a standpoint of prosecuting a global war on terror and also trying to foster democracy in the Middle East, I'm not really sure why that course serves American interests.
So since Hezbollah is on the list of, is on the American list of terrorist groups, if Hezbollah rises to a larger position of political power in Lebanon, what does that mean for relations between America and Lebanon?
Well, that's a very good question. We face this problem in Iraq. One of the leading Shia Islamist parties, the so-called Dawa Party, up until the time of the American military campaign in Iraq, was labeled a foreign terrorist organization, and we simply removed them from the list of foreign terrorist organizations so that we could begin working with them. And now, you know, they've emerged as one of the major players in Iraqi politics. In terms of how we deal with Lebanon, assuming that Hezbollah does become a more powerful and politically influential player, that's a good question. It is really hard for me to imagine, given Hezbollah's history, given the reality that I don't see Hezbollah disarming anytime soon. It's really hard for me to see how this administration could make an argument that Hezbollah should be removed from the list of foreign terrorist organizations. At a minimum, I think it would mean that to the extent Hezbollah is taken into a Lebanese government, you know, there are going to be large parts of that government that the United States simply can't deal with on an official basis.
My guest is Flint Leverett. His new book, Inheriting Syria, will be published in a couple of weeks. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
My guest is Flint Leverett, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution's Saban Center for Middle East Policy. You worked as an expert on Syria in the Bush administration, and you resigned over a conflict in policy. What was your disagreement with the Bush administration?
I had, I would say, three conflicts with the administration that eventually brought me to a point where I felt I needed to leave. One was not Syria specific, but it did relate to the question of U.S. policy toward state sponsors of terror, Syria being one of those countries. I believed that in the aftermath of the September 11 attacks, we had real opportunities with Syria, with Iran, with other countries of concern that were coming to us in the aftermath of the attacks, offering us various kinds of cooperation against al-Qaeda, in the case of Iran, offering to work with us to establish a post-Taliban regime in Afghanistan. And while, you know, I certainly have no illusions about these countries' own complicity in various types of terrorist activity, I believed we had a real opportunity to engage these countries, take their cooperation against al-Qaeda, and use that to leverage improvements in their behavior on terrorism and other issues of concern, and basically start a process where we could get these countries out of the terrorism business in return for a better, closer strategic relationship with the United States. I believe that was in U.S. interests in terms of our foreign policy. I believe that was in our interests in terms of prosecuting the global war on terror more effectively and more efficiently. The administration basically went in the other direction. It said for state sponsors of terror, we are not going to basically offer positive inducements for changes in behavior. These countries will simply have to get out of the terrorism business because it's the right thing to do. I don't think that approach has been very effective, and I disagreed with the policy on that issue.
What was another conflict that you had with the Bush administration?
One of the issues that I worked very hard on was the Palestinian issue. I think it's fair to say one of the four or five people most responsible for the content of the roadmap for Israeli-Palestinian peace. We actually wrote the roadmap with the idea that it would be put out before the end of 2002 in the run-up to the Iraq War, as a way of giving the United States a defensible position on the Palestinian issue going into the Iraq War. The administration, though, made a decision in late 2002 because Prime Minister Sharon called early elections in Israel that it would not put out the roadmap before the Israeli elections. The argument was if we did that, we would be intervening in Israeli politics. My argument was that if we, after we've told the world we will put out a plan for Israeli-Palestinian peace before we go to war in Iraq, and we don't do that simply because Prime Minister Sharon has asked us not to, then we are intervening in Israeli politics just in a different direction. What can I say? I lost that argument. The roadmap was not put out on the schedule that I think it should have been put out. And I came to a conclusion that the administration was fundamentally not serious about dealing with the Palestinian issue. And that was another reason I felt it was probably a good idea for me to move on.
Was there a third conflict?
Yes. In late 2002, the administration brought in Elliot Abrams to be senior director for Near East and North African Affairs and to work alongside me as senior director for Middle East Affairs with the idea that we would be able to work together and deal with issues in this part of the world. I thought, frankly, that even though I tried for a few weeks to work with Elliot, that this was really a sign of a lack of seriousness on the administration's part about dealing with these issues in a really creative and forthright way. It's not just a question that Elliot and I had very different perspectives on the region and what U.S. policy should be, but Elliot was someone who, apart from his previous entanglement in the Iran-Contra affair, had no experience working on Middle East issues. And I thought his appointment was a very politically calculated signal that we weren't going to be doing strategically grounded diplomacy in this region.
What was Abrams' involvement in Iran-Contra?
Elliot Abrams, in the end, pled guilty to, I believe it was two counts of lying to Congress about the plan to divert resources from the sale of anti-aircraft missiles to Iran for use by the Nicaraguan Contras, even though Congress had said U.S. aid was not supposed to go to the Contras. Elliot pled guilty to making false statements to Congress regarding this matter. The first President Bush, the current president's father, pardoned Abrams shortly before he left office.
So you have your disagreements with the Bush administration. What kind of policy would you like to see toward Syria or toward Lebanon?
Well, I think that our policy toward Syria and Lebanon needs to be put, first of all, in a bigger strategic context. I think that the real threat to U.S. interests in this part of the world and globally comes from Sunni Islamist extremism epitomized by al-Qaeda. The course that I recommended in the aftermath of September 11 would be to focus like a laser beam on that threat. I think we did the right thing going into Afghanistan. I was one of a small group of people called back into the State Department on the night of September 11th to put together the diplomatic strategy for assembling the coalition that would go after al-Qaeda and the Taliban. I think we got started off right. I think we lost our focus in the war on terror against Sunni Islamist terror, largely because of Iraq. I also think we needed, alongside a very robust campaign against al-Qaeda, we needed a diplomatic approach of what I would call tough-minded carrots and sticks engagement with state sponsors of terrorism like Iran, like Syria. In this approach, you would go to these states and you would say, okay, you want to be helpful with us to us against al-Qaeda, that's fine, but we also have concerns about your involvement with groups that we consider terrorist. We need to have a serious conversation about what it would take to get you guys out of the terrorist business. We're prepared to talk to you about what the benefits would be to you for doing that in terms of a better relationship with the United States, strategic economic benefits that would flow from that. But we also want you to understand that there are going to be negative consequences for you if you don't get out of the terrorism business. That's the kind of approach that I favor to a state, toward a state like Syria. It's not one that the administration has wanted to pursue. And finally, I think you do need to give a really high profile in your regional diplomacy to efforts to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
There was some pretty tough talk on the part of the Bush administration towards Syria after we invaded Iraq. Do you think the Bush administration ever seriously entertain the idea of invading Syria in a way similar to the way we invaded Iraq?
There are those in the administration, particularly in the office of the Secretary of Defense and in the Vice President's office, who've always wanted to push that as a serious policy option. It never has been adopted as policy, in part because the time has never been right, and particularly in the aftermath of the Iraqi campaign, American military forces in the region were seriously overstretched, and it just wasn't feasible at that point to go after another Middle Eastern rogue state. I think what's going on now is those voices in the administration who might argue for some kind of engagement with Syria have gotten weaker, particularly as the president has gone into his second term. And those voices in the administration who are arguing for, in effect, a policy of regime change towards Syria have gotten stronger. And I think this is not a helpful trend, because I think that if the United States tries to pursue coercive regime change in Syria, it will basically create more problems than it solves. And I think the United States could achieve its policy objectives towards Syria more efficiently through what I describe as tough-minded conditional engagement.
When you say coercive regime change, are you talking about invasion? Or are you talking about CIA covert operations?
I think there are a couple of different scenarios. One would be an outright invasion, basically like we did in Iraq. Another alternative that some people are interested in is using external opposition forces, much as we tried to do in Iraq, use external opposition forces to push on the regime. This is part of why I think that the administration has latched onto the opening that was created by former Prime Minister Hariri's assassination to push on the issue of Syria's presence in Lebanon. The administration believes that if it can push Syria out of Lebanon, this will weaken Syria's position and weaken the regime so much in Damascus that within not that much time, it will start to unravel. So if we can't free up the forces to invade Syria, there may be, in this view, other ways that we could force a regime transformation, regime change in Damascus.
Flint Leverett, his new book, Inheriting Syria, will be published in mid-April. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from this and other NPR member stations. And from Barnes & Noble, featuring the 2005 ESPN Baseball Encyclopedia from Sterling Publishing, a division of Barnes & Noble. And from Aveda, working to save threatened and endangered plant species with beauty that cares for the Earth, Earth Month, and every day, on the web at aveda.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more on political changes in Lebanon and Syria. We continue our conversation with Flint Leverett, the author of Inheriting Syria. Then we'll talk with Elizabeth Dibble in the State Department, and we'll call Rami Khoury in Beirut, where he's editor-at-large of the Daily Star newspaper and writes a syndicated column. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Flint Leverett. He's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution's Saban Center for Middle East Policy. Leverett's new book, Inheriting Syria, is about Bashar al-Assad, who took over as president of Syria in 2000 after the death of his father, President Hafez al-Assad. The book will be published in mid-April. Let's look at the regime in Syria now. The president of Syria, Bashar al-Assad, is the son of the former president of Syria, Hafez al-Assad.
Yes.
How do their regimes compare?
I would say that Bashar, the son, is in many respects a different character from his father. He's obviously from a different generation. He's had different formative experiences. He received at least part of his education in the West. And I think that Bashar is someone who, in contrast to his father, recognizes that things need to be different in Syria. The economy needs to be modernized. Certain types of social reform need to move forward, particularly to try and weaken people's sense of sectarian identity in Syria. over the long run, he professes interest in political liberalization and political opening. I don't want to overstate that. Bashar's experience in the West was basically in the context of what we in the United States would describe as an ophthalmology residency program in London. He was originally planning to be a doctor and to become an eye surgeon. It was only when his older brother, Basil, was killed in an automobile accident in 1994 that he was plucked out of that life as a medical resident in London and told he was going to need to prepare himself to become president of Syria. He's someone who has come to office while he has the sense that things need to be different. He doesn't have a well-elaborated vision for how to transform Syria. And he doesn't have as large a reservoir of world-class technocratic talent around him as he needs to develop that vision.
Is he or was his father brutal in terms of treatment of their own people?
His father was certainly an authoritarian ruler who was prepared to put down challenges to his authority with whatever degree of force was required. The high point of that was in 1982 when he ordered the suppression of a revolt in the Syrian city of Hama. Somewhere between 10 and 20,000 Syrians died in that assault. Hafez al-Assad was certainly a very, very hard authoritarian ruler who used coercion as he felt he needed to preserve his hold on power. Bashar is someone who I think is less inclined in that direction, but who is hemmed in by his own lack of technocratic capacity and who is hemmed in by very powerful elements of the system that he inherited from his father. And I think Bashar's strategy is to avoid a confrontation with this so-called old guard that he inherited from his father, but rather to develop his own personal network of supporters and advisors, and basically over time figure that biology is on his side. He's going to be able to outweigh, outlast, outlive this old guard, and over time replace them with his own people. This is a very gradualist view of reform, and I think the real critical question is, given Bashar's deteriorating strategic situation, does he really have time for that kind of approach?
Is Bashar al-Assad any easier to negotiate with for the United States than his father was?
Hafez al-Assad was a notoriously difficult negotiating partner. American secretaries of state, from Henry Kissinger to James Baker, Warren Christopher, have all written about this. Dennis Ross has written about it. It's not really clear at this point what kind of negotiator his son would be, because, frankly, we have not really tried. It's interesting to note that Bashar's coming to power coincided more or less with the collapse of the Syria track of the Middle East peace process in 2000. And without a Syria track, the United States, for the most part under the Bush administration, has not since 2000 had a strategic framework for engaging Syria. We have a list of complaints about Syrian behavior on terrorism, on hegemony in Lebanon, on other issues. And we keep reiterating those complaints, but we don't really have a strategic dialogue in the sense of talking with them about, here's what we need you to do, and if you cooperate with us, here are the benefits that could flow to you. We don't really have that kind of dialogue with Syria, so we don't really know at this point what kind of negotiator Bashar would be. What we do know is that he is consistently expressing an interest in this kind of strategic dialogue with the United States.
You've said that you could learn something about who Bashar al-Assad is by looking at the woman who he chose to marry. Tell us something about her and what you think she says about him.
Asma al-Assad is the daughter of a Syrian expatriate physician, a world-class interventional cardiologist in London. She was born and raised and educated entirely in the UK, graduated from the University of London in computer science, went through the investment banker training program at JP Morgan, worked at Deutsche Bank, and had been accepted into the MBA program at Harvard Business School when Bashar proposed to her. I think, among other things, what Bashar's choice of her says is that he is someone, first of all, he married her over his mother's objections, which is in Arab culture a not insignificant thing. But it says to me that he is someone who is genuinely open to new ways of doing things in Syria. The person he picked to be right next to him is someone who has had world-class exposure to the most developed aspects of the globalized economy of the 21st century, and who has emerged in her own right as a kind of champion of civil society and NGOs in Syria. So I find his choice of her kind of confirmation at a very important emotional level that at some level, Bashar really is a different kind of leader and wants things to be different in his country.
Well, Flint Leverett, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Flint Leverett's new book, Inheriting Syria, will be published in mid-April. Coming up, Elizabeth Dibble from the State Department's Bureau of Near Eastern Affairs. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the political changes in Lebanon and Syria and what they mean for the Middle East and for the U.S. My next guest, Elizabeth Dibble, works in the State Department's Bureau of Near Eastern Affairs. In reaction to the massive demonstrations last month in Beirut calling for Syria to withdraw its forces from Lebanon, the pro-Syrian Prime Minister Omar Karami resigned. Then he returned to lead the formation of a new government. After failing to make much progress, he announced he intends to resign again. What do you think it would mean politically if the Lebanese Prime Minister Omar Karami did resign?
Well, he has stated his intention to resign. Right now, we have a situation of paralysis, if you will, in the Lebanese political scene because he has been unable to form a government. And Lebanon needs to form a government in order to enact legislation that will allow the parliamentary elections to go forward as scheduled by the end of May. And this is the real crucial point. The government needs to be formed, not necessarily by Karami. He has not been successful so far, but there needs to be a government in place that can enact the elections legislation and prepare for the elections.
Do you think that the massive demonstrations in Lebanon that protested the presence of Syrian troops in Lebanon were connected to the elections in Iraq, or do you think the two things are more coincidence?
I think the two things are more coincidence, although certainly is a demonstration effect that we're seeing across the Middle East, because it wasn't just the elections in Iraq, the Palestinian elections. We're seeing people across the Middle East find their political voice, if you will. But I think the demonstrations in Lebanon were sparked much more by the assassination of former Prime Minister Hariri and the popular uprising, sort of enough is enough, Syria has to get out, and the Lebanese people deserve to determine their own political future free of foreign interference.
Hezbollah is on the American list of terrorist groups. In Lebanon, Hezbollah is a strong political party, a party that might, in fact, get stronger if Syria does pull out of Lebanon. And, you know, there were two sets of demonstrations after the assassination of the Lebanese prime minister, one by large groups of people who want Syria out of Lebanese politics. But the other demonstrations were pro-Hezbollah, and Hezbollah has been aligned with Syria. So what do you think is going to be the future of Hezbollah?
Hezbollah is, in our view, as you noted, a terrorist organization. They have advocated the use of violence and terror as a political tool. Part of UN Security Council Resolution 1559 talks about the disarming of all militias in Lebanon. That includes Hezbollah. As the president has said, however, the immediate focus right now is on getting the Syrians out and holding Lebanese parliamentary elections, free and fair and credible elections without foreign influence or interference. And if Hezbollah renounces terror and violence and the Lebanese people decide that there is a place in the political spectrum for Hezbollah, you know, that will be their decision to make. But it's hard to see how a group that advocates the use of terror and violence can also have a place in the political spectrum. You can't have it both ways.
If Hezbollah takes on a larger political role in the political life of Lebanon, would the United States be willing, do you think, to work with it, or would it be forced to work with it?
Absent a change in Hezbollah's behavior, policies, and outlook, as long as Hezbollah is still a terrorist organization and advocates the use of terror and violence for political means, there I don't see any way that the United States could work with Hezbollah.
Now, Syria has been on the U.S. list of state sponsors of terror. And there were some very harsh words that the Bush administration used about Syria shortly after the invasion of Iraq. Was regime change ever considered, a forced regime change in Syria as it was in Iraq?
Our concerns with Syrian behavior are multiple, and they're not new concerns. They are longstanding concerns. That includes Syrian behavior with regard to Iraq, including Syrian support for former regime elements and members of the insurgency, Syrian support for the insurgents. It includes Syrian support for the Palestinian rejectionist groups, Hamas, Palestinian Islamic Jihad. It includes Syrian support for Hezbollah. It includes Syria's role in Lebanon and the fact that Syria has is still in Lebanon and exerts a very powerful grip on Lebanon. So our concerns with Syria sort of are cut across a number of issues. Congress passed and the president signed the Syria Accountability Act, which went into effect almost a year ago, which mandated additional sanctions on top of the sanctions that were already in place due to Syria's role as a state supporter of terrorism. So our concerns with the Syrian with Syrian behavior and with the behavior of the Syrian government were well known and were well documented, and we have continued to make those concerns known to the Syrian government. At the same time, because we've made those concerns known to the Syrian government knows what it needs to do if it wants a better relationship with the United States.
But has regime change ever been on the table?
The Syrian government knows what it needs to do in terms of changing its behavior toward all of these issues or vis-a-vis all of these issues. If it wants a better relationship with the United States.
I don't hear you saying, no, regime change is not and has never been on the table.
I'm just going to repeat what I said before.
Do you think that there's hope for better relations with Bashar al-Assad than there was with his father, Hafez al-Assad, the president of Syria, and now it's his son, Bashar?
That's a difficult question because I think when Bashar al-Assad became president nearly 5 years ago, he came with a reputation of obviously being the next generation, the younger generation, perhaps more reform-oriented, that he would make some changes in Syria, economic changes. He was known to be computer literate and a fan of the Internet. So I think when he became president, there were many who were willing to give him the benefit of the doubt to see if he really would change the direction of Syrian policy on a number of issues, you know, across the board. He hasn't done that. He has not indicated that he's willing to change behavior in ways that would indicate that Syria wants to sort of become more integrated into the region and to improve its relations with the United States.
Elizabeth Dibble, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Elizabeth Dibble is Deputy Assistant Secretary in the State Department's Bureau of Near Eastern Affairs. Coming up, we talk with Rami Khoury in Beirut, where he's editor-at-large of the Daily Star newspaper. This is Fresh Air. We're devoting today's program to the political changes in Lebanon and Syria and what they mean for the Middle East and the U.S. Earlier today, we phoned Rami Khoury in Beirut, where he's editor-at-large of the Daily Star newspaper and writes a syndicated column. Last month's protests in Beirut against Syria's military presence in Lebanon led to the resignation of the pro-Syrian Prime Minister Omar Karami. Then he returned to the government, but recently announced his plans to resign again. The Prime Minister, Omar Karami, resigned once before. What would be the significance if he does follow through and resign again?
Well, it's not actually a resignation. He's been designated to try to form a new government. So he's a kind of a designated government former, or whatever they call that in political terms. Now, he's not having much success, so he will probably go back to president and say, look, I can't form a government, pick somebody else to do it. The significance of that is that the political alignments are simply not there right now to create a government of national unity under Karami, and there will have to be an accelerated attempt to do that because it's absolutely critical to get a government in place so that they can make an electoral law and hold the parliamentary elections on schedule during May. So there's a series of things that have to happen. The first one is to form a government.
Do you think that there's any chance that as Syria continues to withdraw, assuming it does continue to withdraw from Lebanon, that Lebanon might have more factional fighting or return to a state of civil war?
No, I don't think there's any significant chance or any slight chance of that at all, because the circumstances of the civil war starting in 1975 are completely different than the circumstances today. The other more important point is that every single Lebanese leader and politician and street market vegetable vendor and TV personality and every single person who has said anything in public in the last 6 weeks has said that there will be no return to fighting. that the country is unified. There are political disagreements, some really strong ones, but there is a tremendously high level of awareness of both the futility and the cost of returning to internal fighting. So I think it's really out of the question that that's going to happen.
Hezbollah is on the U.S. list of terrorist groups. Hezbollah is a big political party in Lebanon, a party that has a lot of power now. It's a group that's aligned with Syria. If Syria continues to pull out of Lebanon, how will that change the power of Hezbollah? And what kind of power do you think Hezbollah would have in a new government in Lebanon?
Hezbollah is an extremely legitimate, strong party. It is the single biggest, most organized political grouping in Lebanon. They have tremendous legitimacy from their activities in the south to drive out the Israelis who had occupied the south from 1982 to 2000. They have a massive social welfare program which helps a lot of people. They have about 500,000 people that they can call on, which is about 1/6 of the population. And they're the single biggest and probably the most legitimate grouping in Lebanon, though they've always stayed out of sort of day-to-day politics. So the challenge now is to figure out where they will fit into the new system. And they're still studying that. They're looking themselves at what's the best thing for them to do, how deeply to get engaged in domestic politics, or should they just stay at the strategic level. For instance, they've never agreed to be part of any government or accept a cabinet post, even though they're in parliament. Now they're thinking maybe they should do that. And so these are the kind of issues they're looking at.
Do you think that the demonstrations in Lebanon to get Syria out of Lebanon are a reflection of the democratizing influence of the elections in Iraq?
No, not at all. I think the elections in Iraq certainly may have some impact around the region. The whole American regime change by a preemptive war in Iraq certainly may have some impact on the region, but we haven't seen it yet, and it certainly hasn't shown up in the street demonstrations.
What would you say, what is the range of popular opinion in Lebanon about the U.S. invasion of Iraq and the recent election there?
I think, in Lebanon and the whole region, you have a pretty, consistent situation. My sense has always been that there's a small minority of people in the Arab world who actively and enthusiastically supported what the United States did in Iraq. And maybe 10-15% of people in this region, I think, were really very much for what the U.S. did. The vast majority in the Arab world were critical of what the United States did in Iraq in terms of the preemptive war and the regime change and all that. Now, when the elections took place in Iraq, that was an interesting and a rather different moment because the enthusiasm with which the Iraqis voted, at least those who voted, was really quite striking. And I think many of us in the Arab world kind of paused for a moment. And it caused, I think, a lot of people to start shifting a little bit from being critical of what the United States had done in the past in Iraq, in the recent past, shifting towards being more aware of and supportive of what the Iraqi people themselves were trying to do to chart out their own future in a participatory and democratic way. So I think it was a turning point.
Is there any action that you would like to see the Bush administration take now in terms of Syria's relationship to Lebanon or the future of democracy in Lebanon? And is there anything you would particularly like not to see them do?
Well, whether it's in Lebanon or in Syria or in the whole Middle East, I think what I would say is that it's really great to hear the American president talk about promoting democracy and freedom as an official American policy. I mean, I think this is terrific. We've been waiting for this for about 2.5 generations, so it's a great thing. But the problem with it is it's not taken very credibly here in the region by most people because it's so inconsistent and selectively applied. So what we would like to see is a consistent American policy. I think consistency is the single biggest and most useful thing the United States can do. And there is a role for foreign countries, Europe, the Americans, whoever, Japan, to promote democracy and freedom. Absolutely, there is a role for foreign countries, but they must do it consistently. If they want to promote the freedom of the Lebanese from the Syrians, they must also promote the freedom of the Palestinians from the Israelis. So I think we're on the verge of potentially a historic turning point, but it's got to be consistent.
Well, Rami Khoury, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me. My pleasure.
Rami Khoury spoke to us from Beirut, where he's editor-at-large of the Daily Star newspaper and writes a syndicated column. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Sherrock. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From the Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable, and sustainable society. And from Capella University, offering bachelor's, MBA, master's, and doctoral degrees online at capella.edu. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Edward Conlon talks about his book Blue Blood, his memoir about working as a detective with the NYPD. It's just been published in paperback. And Robert Sullivan tells us about doing research in the alleys of Manhattan for his book Rats, which has also just come out in paperback. Join us for the next Fresh Air.